You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey, everybody. We're back with another Bald Move Television podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for all of TV. I'm Aaron.
I'm Jim.
Jim, I saw the outline for today's episode. I feel like we always cover all of television. We said we're going to narrow our focus down to one television show, and now we're talking about all of television, it seems like. We're going to talk Emmy nominations, some Stranger Things. Like,
I can't resist.
Not even 1 week could we stay true to our mission of not covering all of television.
We have opposing missions. That's the problem.
We do. We do. Which of the two topics, the B-plots of this episode, shall we say, do we want to talk about first? The Emmy nominations that were released last week, or the Stranger Things Season 3 teaser trailer that was released, I think, yesterday?
Yeah, it was. Let's start with the Emmys.
Okay. You and I both don't think much of award shows.
Even though, including our own.
The Baldies is the second least ridiculous award show on the planet. I'll let you guys figure out what the number one is. But the Emmys, they came out. Like, I think the Emmys are even historically bad. I always hold the fact that they didn't ever give any love to The Wire. Mm-hmm. I hold against them that they didn't give any love to real love to The Leftovers like I thought it deserved. I feel like once they finally do get around to recognizing somebody like Breaking Bad, then it just gets stuck in between their teeth and they can't help but nominate these people again and again and again.
Yeah.
Like Peter Dinklage could have died last season and he will still get nominated for season 8 of Game of Thrones because that's what you do once you get on. Mm-hmm. But I know that we're in a minority and a lot of people like to talk about these fucking awards. So, have you seen the list of the nominations?
I'm looking at them right now. I hadn't seen them until about 5 seconds ago. So.
Okay. I do think that they did a typically kind of slipshod job on the dramatic series, but I thought this comedy series were not terrible.
Okay.
Do you want to just go by them through category? I've got a list from Vox here.
Just a few of the categories. We're not going to do them all.
No. Like, I think the top six, like the series and then the actors. Outstanding Comedy Series, nominated Atlanta, Barry, Blackish, Curb Your Enthusiasm, Glow, The Marvelous Miss Maisel, Silicon Valley, and Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Honestly, the only one I'm entirely unfamiliar with here is The Marvelous Miss Maisel. Hmm. Despite Netflix's best efforts, I have not clicked play on that banner.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a strong category. Like it, to me, it's a race between Atlanta and Barry.
Okay.
I know you haven't seen any of Atlanta,
the only ones I've seen on here are Barry, Glow, Silicon Valley, and I saw not last season of Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, but I feel like I know what that show is.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, of the three seasons that I watched last year, I guess Barry was the best, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Glow was really good. I really liked Glow. Silicon Valley, it was okay.
I think Silicon Valley and like Curb Your Enthusiasm are there because
that's what you do. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I heard that this last season, I haven't seen this last season of Curb, but I heard it was just kind of like a comeback season. And mm-hmm. Silicon Valley was the best season they've had in a long time, but far from the heights of the show.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
Barry, it was its debut season, and it was surprising how good that was.
Indifferent. I like it when the Emmys or any award show can reward a risky success.
Yeah.
Something that took a lot of risks, and I think Barry, it took some challenging material. Like, I've seen Assassins with Hearts of Gold before, Gross Point Blank, etc.
Sure.
But they didn't really do, I mean, they did an interesting job where it's very complicated how you feel about Barry by the end. Mm-hmm. And, like, whether he's a good guy under it all. And what does that even mean? Like, how can you maintain your good guy status? Or is that, like, is that just a way you carry yourself? Or is it the accumulation of the things you do? And I think it's got some interesting conclusions. I can't wait to see season two of that. Mm-hmm. Atlanta was just, like, a tour de force. Like, the stuff that Donald Glover is trying to say about, I guess, his particular view of the black experience of America is amazing. It's hard for me to comment on, because a lot of stuff is, like, shit that I'm finding out or, like, getting the emotional truth of for the first time. Mm-hmm. So, but it also remains, like, extremely funny, and a lot of the humor comes from, like, their great characters and their great cast, not so much as, like, a situational comedy, because there's nothing funny about being jumped for your jewelry and then running through a woods afraid that you're going to be murdered, you know? That's not a funny situation.
What if you did it in Tidy Whiteys?
sure. If it's Walt and Jesse and they're dissolving someone at the end in the bathtub, fine.
Okay.
But yeah, it's similar to that. Like, finding the humor in these black situations, like, emotionally and skin color, I think it does really well. And I will be, I mean, honestly, I think we should all join together and burn the Emmys down if one of these two doesn't win.
Okay. Sure.
I mean, Blackish is also,
I don't see anything there that would compete with them, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, Blackish is also very good, but it's not better than Atlanta. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the outstanding drama series, The Americans. Okay.
Yeah, I heard this was the best season of an already amazing show.
Okay.
To wrap it up. So, yeah, I haven't seen it since, like, season 3 or 4.
Right. That's when we jointly bailed. I guess I was the one that bailed.
And you bailed, and it kind of crushed my spirit on that show. So I just haven't caught up with it.
The spirit, like so many Swedish diplomats, and stuffed it into a suitcase. The Crown, which is something I really want to see because it's right up my alley. It's all about that British, you know, upper crust bullshit, and it's well acted and it looks amazing. But I haven't seen it, so I can't commentate on it. Game of Thrones.
This is
outrageous. Game of Thrones had a very uneven penultimate season that much depends on the finale season. I am aghast that the zombie husk of season 7 Game of Thrones made it onto. Although it is, even when it's not firing on all cylinders, it's still awesome to look at and has 2 or 3 moments per year where they're just like drop your jaw on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
I wish they felt more organic. This season, everything felt very set PC, trying to get to these three, you know, literally trying to check off these three bullet points that Martin gave us 7 years ago.
Yeah.
Handmaid's Tale, man, season 1 is amazing. I think that's what we're talking about. I mm-hmm. think season 2 is so searing that Seth and I are having a hard time making it through.
Oh, boy.
It's just fucking bleak, man.
Yeah. It's like The Americans.
Except for instead of the heroes being Russian agents mm-hmm. fighting against the American democracy, the heroes are just women. Just women.
Okay.
Just women trying not to be treated as cattle.
Yeah.
Literally cattle. And it's the performance as well. Stranger Things, season 2.
It's a weird one. I don't really consider Stranger Things like a serious drama. It's really fun show. It's not quite a comedy. It's not quite a drama. It's like all of those things rolled into one, and it doesn't really seem to fit in my mind in any category.
Yeah, it's almost like Spielberg 80s adventure.
Yeah, like if there was a nostalgia category, biggest nostalgia boner, this would be in it. But, like, I don't know. It's not great drama. There are a couple of things, like Hopper and Eleven's relationship.
Last season
was pretty good.
But I thought that there was a lot of really strong performances. The kid, Will.
Absolutely.
Wasn't Will the one that was like,
yeah, I think they should be nominated for their performances. But the series as a whole is like, is that serious drama?
I mean, if it's not funny, it's got to be drama, right?
I guess. Or can it just be, like, fun, you know?
Like, how is it different from, like, I guess Breaking Bad in that way?
Breaking Bad was always, like, a really intense character.
Gets
study.
Dark. It's dark. It's as dark as you can get starring a bunch of 12 and 13 year olds.
Yeah.
Like Goonies is as dark.
And being true to the era.
Like it's like imagine if Goonies the movie was Midnight Black. Mm-hmm. Like maybe the Fratellis will kill a kid.
Right.
Maybe Chunk doesn't walk out of that basement.
Yeah.
But yeah, I get your. I guess I don't feel as strongly about it as you do. Because I think.
I mean,
that,
I'm not
like,
saying it shouldn't be there at right. all. But like I'm cool with it being recognized because it's an amazing show. It's probably my favorite show on TV. But like drama.
I don't know. This Is Us, the juggernaut that
yeah.
I refuse to see.
Refuse to see it?
For misguided principles, I suppose. I'm just not interested in seeing it.
Okay.
Like, even the defenders kind of say it's kind of schmaltzy, and that's kind of an anathema to me. And then Westworld,
yeah.
Which is another kind of Game of Thronesy. If you're going to give, like what other series got overlooked? What was the one with Michelle Dockery and where the villain was Jeff Daniels?
Oh, yeah.
Godless?
Godless.
Like, isn't Godless better than Westworld?
Yeah, Godless was really strong.
Like, Godless didn't have Kitsumi.
It was a limited Kitsuya. Run thing, though, right? It wasn't a
yeah,
series.
I guess that's
so
true.
It
and
be
they
in
do
this
have
category.
The limited series of role. Let's see. Did that get into it? No, it didn't make it there either.
No.
I'm not going to go through that category because I haven't seen literally any of them.
But yeah, I thought Mr. Robot Season 3 was much better than Westworld
there
Season 2.
There you go. Two. That's a good comparison.
Wait, is this Westworld Season 1
season
or 2?
For
okay.
sure. And I actually think Handmaid's Tale Season 2, too. Like, the way this stuff works is the cutoffs are...
Okay, then yeah, I don't think Westworld should have been in that, just personally speaking.
Let's go to lead actor in a comedy series, Anthony Anderson Blackish. I've seen some of that show, but not enough to even recognize the actor. Ted Danson from The Good Place. Good Place, another show. A lot of people say we need to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And Ted Danson's good. We know this. Larry David from Curb Your Enthusiasm. You know, whatever.
He's Larry David.
Donald Glover in Atlanta absolutely deserves it because, like, his fingerprints are all over this thing. He probably is the person that does the craziest shit in the season. Absolutely deserving. Bill Hader, Barry. Mm-hmm. And then the, you know, keep doing what you're doing slot. William H. Macy from Shameless, which it's a great show, too. But again,
and I really like Mr. Macy.
I do, too. I could throw a parade, a Macy's Day parade, you might say. Donald Glover and Bill Hader. Again, this is a two man race in my mind. I mean, maybe Ted Danson deserves to be in there, but I find it hard to believe that he's doing something better than Donald Glover or Bill Hader are doing in Atlanta and Barry.
Mm-hmm.
Supporting actor in comedy series, Brian Tyree Henry, who plays Paperboy in Atlanta, who was almost the star of the show this year. Henry Winkler from Barry, who was very funny, very good. Louis Anderson from Baskets, who is very funny, very good playing Baskets' mother.
Mm-hmm.
Alec Baldwin playing Trump for the last 2 years on Saturday Night Live. Kenan Thompson, Saturday Night Live.
For still being on Saturday Night Live after
and you know what?
35 years.
Kenan is the anchor of that show.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Like, he is sneaky good. Mm-hmm. Tony Shalhoub, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, rather, and Titus Burgess, The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Mm. Very funny.
Yeah.
This guy is like the star of the show as far as I'm concerned.
Uh-huh.
I've seen enough to know that. Who do you think should win on this one?
Damn. I thought like Henry Winkler was good in Barry, but I don't know that he was like amazing in Barry. There was something that just didn't, that character, something about that character just didn't sit right with me.
Yeah.
Didn't feel natural enough.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen Louis Anderson in Baskets. I haven't seen Baskets at all.
Mm-hmm. No, I
have a hard time giving it to, well, I have a hard time giving it to Alec Baldwin because he does one character essentially. Kenan Thompson would be more likely because he does everything.
Right.
And he's amazing at it.
He's got a funny face. The man
he
gets,
seems to just enjoy what he's doing.
The
too.
Man gets a lot of mileage out of his reaction shots. I think Brian Tyree Henry, because it's almost cheating since Paperboy is a main character this season, that he gets to be in the supporting actor slot, and he just I think if Henry Winkler, if you're saying it's between Henry Winkler and Kenan Thompson, I'm saying Brian Tyree Henry is like twice as good as either of those guys, in my opinion. Lead actress in a comedy series, Pamela Adlon, Better Things, blah. Rachel Brosnan, Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, I haven't seen it.
I've seen zero of these shows.
Allison Janney, Mom, blah. Issa Rae, Insecure. All right. Tracy Ellis Ross, Blackish. Okay. Lily Tomlin, Grace and Frank. I haven't seen that, so I guess I'd have to give it to Issa Rae, who is just amazing and Insecure.
So Glow was nominated as an outstanding series, but none of the stars from Glow made it into the lead actress in a comedy series?
Crazy, huh?
Hmm.
Supporting actress in a comedy series, Zazie Beetz, Atlanta. Amazing. You'd recognize her as Domino from the Deadpool 2 movie. Laurie Metcalf as Roseanne. Betty Gilpin from Glow. Oh, so who the hell is Betty Gilpin? Do you know?
That's a good question.
And then three women from Saturday Night Live, Aidy Bryant, Leslie Jones, and Kate McKinnon. All very funny. I think it's tough because Kate McKinnon is like going to be the breakout star of this of this female portion of the cast. Uh-huh. I can't wait till she starts, you know, ripping off very funny movies. Alex Borstein from The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel and Megan Mullally from Will and Grace. Ooh, wow. Okay. That's right. Will and Grace came back this year. I guess Megan Mullally was a delight, as she usually is.
Yeah, I didn't catch it, even though I was a mild fan of the original.
Yeah.
Betty Gilpin is the friend of the main character. And I kind of look at her as a lead as well. Like,
yeah.
Those two are kind of the leads, in my opinion. But yeah. I guess they're counting her as a supporting actress.
Lead actor in a drama series, Jason Bateman, Ozark. Okay, whatever.
Yeah.
Matthew Reese, The Americans, does fine work, I'm sure. Sterling K. Brown, This Is Us. I've never seen This Is Us, but I have seen Sterling K. Brown in a lot, and I'm very impressed with him. So you recognize this person?
Milo Ventimiglia? Yeah, that's a name I've not heard in a long time. It's, I don't remember his name. He was the star of Heroes.
Oh,
the lead of Heroes.
Okay, yeah. I recognize him.
He's Rocky's kid in the Rocky Rap Balboa movie.
Ed Harris from Westworld is very good. Very good in a kind of a weird season. And Jeffrey Wright, Westworld also. I guess I'd have to give it to either Ed or Jeff.
I mean, there was nothing wrong with their performances.
No.
They were both stellar, and I don't even know how to choose between the two of them, honestly.
Right. They both did a lot of heavy lifting, I thought, in service of a bewildering plot. Supporting actor, I mean, it's like, yeah, I guess it'd be one of those two. Flip a coin. It's playing a robot, insane robot unstuck in time, maybe harder? But then again, maybe Ed Harris is also a robot in similar situations. Who the fuck knows? Supporting actor in a drama series, Nikolai Coster-Waldau from Game of Thrones, Jaime Lannister, Peter Dinklage, Tyrion from Game of Thrones, Mandy Patinkin. Fucking kick around in Homeland. Get the fuck out of here.
That show's still on the air.
David Harbour, Stranger Things, uh-huh. Matt Smith, The Crown, and Joseph Fiennes, A Handmaid's Tale. Joseph Fiennes, very creepy and malevolent and banal in The Handmaid's Tale. David Harbour's very good too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he really has great chemistry with his surrogate daughter in 11, and projects like toughness and warmth and vulnerability, and he's funny.
And
like,
also anger, and like,
yeah.
There's a lot going on in his performance there.
I can't wait again to see him as Hellboy.
I think much more so than like Peter Dinklage, for instance.
I mean, Peter
Dinklage season of Game of Thrones
had some decent moments standing up.
I just don't think
Daenerys
the range was there.
And that scene
character
he had when he was treating with his sister. I always like seeing Nikolai's work as Jaime Lannister. But to me, yeah, it's going to be between David Harbour and Joseph Fiennes, and probably David Harbour for me. Lead actress in a drama series, Sandra Oh, Killing Five. Tatiana Maslany from Orphan Black? What the... That show's been on for as long as The Simpsons, right?
Yes.
Carrie Russell,
Tatiana is 45 years old.
She is. There's now 743,000 clones of her.
And she plays every last
she
one.
She plays every one of them.
The finale episode is just going to be her. There's going to be nobody else in it.
They actually film 400 days a year. It's incredible.
Uh-huh.
They find out ways to get more days out of the year. Carrie Russell, the Americans, fine. Claire Foy, Crown, fine. Elizabeth Moss, Handmaid's Tale. Evan Rachel Wood, Westworld. I don't know about Evan Rachel Wood just because I don't know. I think she did a good job portraying what she's supposed to portray, but I wasn't buying what they were selling. I probably have to give it to Elizabeth Moss because her work on Handmaid's Tale is incendiary.
From what I hear, she's going to have some stiff competition from the Americans, as well as Matthew Rhys. I think both Matthew and Carrie.
Is this the final season?
Yeah.
Okay, so people are going to be
although,
really...
Although, I don't know if...
This is like the cherry on top award.
Man, I don't know what the dates are for like submissions and stuff. So right. I assume this is the final season.
Right. If the Americans came out this like early or late spring, early summer, which it did, right? Then it was eligible.
I think so, yeah.
Then finally, supporting actress in a drama series, Lena Headey, Game of Thrones, Sinews, Millie Bobby Brown, Stranger Things.
There we go.
All right, Vanessa Kirby, The Crown, Anne Dowd, The Handmaid's Tale, just a vicious, vicious role that she does so well. Yvonne Strahovski from The Handmaid's Tale, Alexis Bledel from The Handmaid's Tale, Thandie Newton from Westworld. I really enjoyed the work that Miss Newton did in Westworld.
Yep.
But holy cow, you probably got to give it to one of those three women in The Handmaid's Tale. I'd like Millie Bobby Brown. But her standout episode is a little weird for a lot of people, you know, the New Mutants episode. And I think that's going to hurt a little bit. But she was really, really good kind of coming into her own this season. So there's our thoughts on the Emmys. I'm not going to get too excited about anything except for if Barry or Atlanta does not win the comedy category, then like what more evidence do you need that the Emmys has no artistic validity.
Yeah.
Hey, everybody. Want to do some housekeeping before we move on to the next subject. Reminding everybody that we are in the midst of our summer Game of Thrones Season 3 rewatch. This is a big one because it'll essentially give us full coverage of the show. We'll have every season covered. We're doing it in a no-spoiler format. So, like, we're reviewing and talking about the episode as if we've not seen the rest of the season. And then we have a spoiler section at the end where we stop all that. And talk about like the little kernels that we've gained and see them sprout into full stalks of corn.
Yep.
Yeah, that's what you do with kernels.
Absolutely.
You don't have grain kernels. The kernel is just corn. There's no way you have kernels without corn.
Yeah.
You could have Kentucky Fried Chicken kernels. You can have computer kernels. But when you're talking about food, it's got to be corn.
And kernels could probably sprout into generals at some point.
Yeah. I don't know you'd use that terminology, sprouting kernel into a general, but sure. Also something excited about, Better Call Saul Season 4 returns August 6th. That's a Monday. So here in the next few weeks, we'll be doing a preview podcast for that. And then we'll be out with full coverage of that each and every week as it releases. That'll, I'm assuming, be a Wednesday type of podcast. That's how we go. Don't forget, we also did a first-run bald movie, Skyscraper, starring The Rock. That was a lot of fun. We got a general review for everybody, and we got a spoiler-filled review for club members. And then also, I'd be remiss to not mention that my Kickstarter for the book is ongoing at book.baldmove.com. We've raised $11,000 out of a $10,000 goal. We will be announcing some stretch goals this week. There's 22 days left to get in. There's a couple of tiers where you can actually just get a discount on the book if that's what you're wanting. But we also got some really cool merch. It's probably going to be even cooler. Now we got Chase Stone as our artist. Check out book.baldmove.com for all those updates. And let's get back to the episode. Okay, that's Emmy talk. Done with that. 20 minutes. Holy shit, I can't believe we talked that much about it.
Yeah, it's too much. I want to spend like 2 minutes on the Stranger Things Season 3 trailer.
Okay. It's not really a trailer. It's an advertisement for a new mall coming to Hawkins, Indiana.
Yeah. Which is weird because I didn't think Hawkins was nearly big enough to have a mall.
Yeah.
But that's the plot.
That's the thing. Is like, I always thought like that Hawkins was like a Mooresville or smaller. And like, I, you know, look, malls, huge part of the 80s, early 90s kid culture.
The setting is awesome.
The set, it's and it gives a lot of like really cool opportunities for older kids and younger kids to mix together, and for the younger kids to like bum rides off the older kids, and like arcade opportunities and all kinds of really cool storytelling possibilities. It does feel like Hawkins, they should have to drive 20-25 minutes over to the next big town.
For sure.
They should have to drive to the Greenfield or to the Greenwoods or the Plainfields from the Mooresvilles of the world to get there. But, you know, that's not fun, watching people drive for 30 minutes to get anywhere cool.
No. No, it's not. And, you know, with the kids being so young, they can't drive. Their parents have to take them, or Steve would have to take them more likely.
Yeah.
Dustin's going to badger him into
it. I did like Steve working the food court with the Ahoy sailor or whatever.
Yeah. That was good.
That looked really good.
Every single shot, they really... So aside from it being in high def, you know, they do a little bit of, like, artifacting of the image to make it look sort of like it's on a tape or something, or a bad TV signal.
I mean, it
but
does...
But it looks crisp.
That's the thing, like... It does. You are aware that they put all these actors in the 80s clothes, but I thought they really sold like the VHS tape quality of it, and like the kind of shitty lighting. And if
even though it looks 1,000 times better than VHS ever did,
but it
hit
feels
that,
like it
that feeling. Yeah,
like whenever I was watching the kids at the like food court and they're tucking in this food and they're like wearing the like you know the crazy blown out curly poofs in their hair and all that stuff. Yeah. I'm like. Man, that looks exactly like the mid-80s.
Right, and the jazzercise aerobics outfits.
In a way that, like, the show does, but the show reminds me of, like, my own memories.
Yeah.
Like, what it felt like to be in the 80s, whereas this actually captures what the 80s media felt like.
Which is good, because this is supposed to be, you know, 80s commercial. Yeah.
So,
and they took, like, I think almost shot for shot. Like, every shot felt like it was right out of, like, Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Right. Right.
Like, I swear I've seen those exact shots in that movie.
Like, there's a lot. I thought there was a lot of Mallrats type of shenanigans kind of in the margins there.
Looking forward to the guy
bopping with his Sony Walkman cassette, you know. Like it's I think it's a Marty McFly model, too. It had, like, the bright orange, like, ear cups, and maybe someone will torture somebody with the rock and roll music. I don't know. It looks good, though.
Yeah, the Sam Goody, obviously, you had to have one of those.
Oh, yeah, Radio Shack.
Yep.
I was waiting for, like, when they're... I was like, there's got to be a JCPenney, because JCPenney anchored every Midwest mall I've ever been to. Man, malls are really taking a beating right now.
Yep.
Have you been to a mall lately?
Yes, but there's no reason for me to ever go to one.
Like, when I moved here 5 years ago, I lived right next door to a mall, and I'd go there from time to time. And it's just, in the decay it's undergone in the 5 years since I've been here.
Yeah.
It's, man, that's something that really took a 1993 me by surprise. Okay, I think we're ready to talk, to collapse our focus back down to the singular episode, the singular TV show, abandon the premise of all of television, and talk about HBO's Sharp Objects, episode 2, Dirt.
Yeah, I liked it.
Yeah, I was surprised I liked it because I felt like they really... And compiling my notes and putting them in the categories that I want to talk about, I realized that, like, this was a lot of mainlining the mystery and clues. And it went, now that they've established the character of Camille and her mother Adora and Emma, like, they added some new kind of twists on that, but they didn't, like, I felt like over half the screen time of the first episode was devoted to setting up the characters in the town, and now they got down to the business of telling a story, which, since the big hook for me is this... the relationships in a small town and kind of like the weird nostalgia I feel about it all. Like I was impressed that they actually kind of like sucked me into the actual mystery. That's my official. What do you think?
I'm with you. It did feel like there was more mystery pursuit in this one, which is fine with me. I'm still trying to figure out some of those relationships. Like, do you know the actual nature of the relationship between what's her name? Jackie? Is it Jackie?
Yeah.
The like aunt-ish figure?
No.
Like what kind of relationship does she have with Camille?
I don't know. I can speculate if you'd like me to.
Sure, yeah.
There's a scene where like these mean girl queen bees show up at the funeral and kind of like haze Camille a little bit for not being one of them anymore, and for like not being successful by the way they judge it, not being married, not having kids. They don't seem like they're particularly happy, but, you know, whatever. Well-trod territory. I wonder if, like, Adora was the leader of a similar pack of that in high school, and Jackie was one of the acolytes. And
yeah,
and has a way of, like, trying to sympathize, like has a way of sympathizing with Camille because she knows exactly the kind of firepower her mom can bring to bear, and she's probably seen both sides, like the public perfect persona that she just cares about everyone, and which is clearly bullshit. And I felt like that maybe Camille and Jackie, that character, have a little bit in common where they both know what their mother's the mother's lash feels like, and I don't know. That's my speculation.
Well, I mean, definitely we know that Camille has fondness for Jackie, right? Like, she feels like she's the only person who ever really treated her genuinely.
She says, yeah.
And then, you know, the cop casts a little doubt on that, and she's like, yeah, you know, whatever. So yeah, there's clearly mutual, a mutually positive relationship there.
Right.
But I don't know where that's going. They, I don't know if they're doing that just for color or if they're doing that for later reveals.
I don't know. Because the woman in white is interesting because the first person I think of, I think Camille feels the same way because there's a little cutaway subliminal scene, is like her mom. Mm-hmm. You know, like we've seen her mom in these wispy diaphanous gowns, and she's got this, like, she says something at the end, like she tried to help this Natalie Keene, because she reminds her so much of Camille, and it seems like there's a certain type of girl that's being murdered because the, you know, Emma and her group of roller skating mean girls talked about, like, well, it's not the cool girls who are being murdered. It's like the weirdo outcast kind of. I almost wonder if, like, we're supposed to think that maybe Adora is purging the town of Camille type undesirables. Or maybe she's trying to take him under her wing, and when they reject her, I mean, it's so on the nose that it almost makes me think that it's a red herring.
Yeah.
The same way when they showed a police chief, right? they just made a point about how all these teeth are pulled out of, like, pliers with sharp edges, and this motherfucker is trying to straighten out a sign. Like, literally the next scene, he's got vice grips. He's wrenching and pulling and showing his man strength about, like, how many teeth he could pull. Like, come on. Like, he surely is not going to be their murderer.
I don't think
he can't,
so. But...
You can't take a red highlighter and draw this guy out in episode two and have me think that he's going to be the murderer.
Yeah. The only person we know can pull teeth is the cop from wherever he's from.
Right.
So, but suspect number one.
Why would he do that if he used the teeth pull? Like, you know.
Yeah.
It turns out that Detective Willis was the 1983 teeth pulling championship at the Hog Fair in Wichita.
Oh,
my God,
shit.
We should have known. Look at his forearms.
Yep.
They're like Popeye.
The other small, but I feel like revealing character piece that they did, it's very short, but there's a flashback of Camille... Camille's sister, whose name I don't know, and Adora.
Emma? You're talking about dead one?
The dead one, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It starts with an M, I believe.
But she's clearly, like, her mom's showing favor to the young sister.
Yeah.
Taking her into the room, playing with her, whatever, and shutting Camille out.
Uh-huh.
And to me, that kind of sheds some light on this whole thing, because something was wrong even before the lashing out, right? Like the stuff at the funeral, the embarrassment at the funeral.
Yeah.
Things have not been good between Camille and her mother for a very long time.
Right.
And it's almost one of those things where, like, I don't know that this is the case, because Adora seems to judge herself by, you know, those traditional values like family and children and stuff like that. So I don't think that she has this attitude, but sometimes there can be an attitude of, like, especially toward the firstborn, because they're the ones this would apply to most, a feeling of the kid, especially if they were not intended, if, you know, if it was like an accident and oops, got pregnant, now I'm having this kid, you can feel some kind of resentment toward like them for changing your life substantially, because, you know, that's something that's irrevocable. And once the second kid comes along as well, my life was already that.
It's
so
like Beth
you don't feel
from Rick and Morty.
Sure.
You know, she's got a special kind of enmity towards Summer that she doesn't maybe have towards Morty, who's just kind of pathetic. Yeah.
I'm wondering if any of that is playing into it, but it doesn't. I don't think it quite lines up with Adora's values, like I said. I mean, probably want a child, right?
I think all of her on-screen behavior can be attributed to, like, just basic narcissistic personality disorder.
Sure.
Like, Camille was everything that she wanted her to be. She was beautiful and witty, and she was a cheerleader, and then something happened that pierced that veil of perfection and maybe revealed to Adora the things about herself that she's not comfortable about, and suddenly she was this person who was persecuted, and now the younger daughter who, I mean, because that's the thing, like, I even see a little bit how that happens with kids. Like, you know, kids are like 3 or 4, they're showing you see all the cute things that remind you of your strengths and, like, you know, none of your real weaknesses. And then as they start to show those sides of their personality, it's kind of like it's a little bit of a shock to see some of your worst qualities or things you're least proud of, like, reflected in a mirror. Mm. But I think if you got a narcissist person, that must be like nails on a chalkboard. You can't even bear it. Like, these things you buried so far, and you're so careful about erecting this facade so no one can see it. And then, holy shit, there's this copy of you out there with them on a billboard. Like, to me, that's what Adora is going through. And the bullshit that she'll accept from Emma, like that scene where Emma's throwing a fit over the dollhouse, mm-hmm. when we know it's all manufactured and Adora is just allowing it to happen, and like, that's so gross. Like,
yeah, that's what Adora wants in a weird way, you know. It's like she wants to feel like, I guess, she's the most important thing in this child's life, and that these tantrums are like some kind of reflection of her need for her mother, or it's really fucked up, man.
Right, and need for, like, her mom's similar need for, perfection, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, and also, like, this continually infantiling, because she's, like, 14, 15 years old, and, like, she's wearing this, like, disgusting pink... like something that you'd wear out of, like, Little House on the Prairie kind of
like she
job.
Lives in that dollhouse.
Yeah,
she's got, but the whole fucking house is. Did you notice that when the
the
housekeeper is, like, sweeping the floor?
Yeah,
that Emma is sweeping the exact same part of the dollhouse. So this is like she's living in this dollhouse.
Right. I was going to add that was one of the things I wanted to say, because in, like, the subliminal or kind of, like, you know, artsy fartsy section, like, what exactly are they trying to say there? And I think you're spot on. The Emma is a living doll in this house. Mm-hmm. Like, this is it's a micro. It's so weird too. Like, what are the odds that because Hereditary had a big dollhouse component of its plot for similar. Mm-hmm. Like, what are the odds that two things, like, would come out less than 2 months apart that would have such a interesting framing device?
But I don't know. I thought the framing of the timeline there was a little important. Like, this animosity has always been there.
Mm-hmm. There's also, speaking of the maid, there's a lot of interesting subsurface stuff they were doing. Like, did you notice that Adora was always taking away knives from Camille? Like, Camille can't cut her own apple. Like, all the knives are a lot like the...
Yeah.
The maid was, like, locking up all the knives at the end of the scene.
The most ridiculous thing is when she goes to cut that apple.
Uh-huh.
Her mom says, no, let me do that.
And then she just hands it to the maid.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
Yeah. Although I gotta say, the maid's apple slicing technique blew my mind.
Yeah?
She's taking those oblique angles, so, like, at the end, like, you don't actually specifically cut out the core, but at the end you've got this, like, perfect hexagonal. You taught me some things.
It's because she eats those.
She eats the apple
cores.
That's
the cores, yeah.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
She leaves as much of the meat as possible on the core.
Oh, right. Yeah. But no, I'd like, my eyes are open to the perfect way to slice an apple from its core.
Mm.
Bravo. I don't know. Honestly, some of the stuff that Adora and Emma get up to is just... hard for me to watch. It's hard for me to watch because, like, I've seen some of these dynamics in my own family, and like the scene in the funeral where, like, Adora snatches the pin from Camille and is causing this big scene in the guise of not making a scene and look like it's that's so specific to some of my experiences with my mother, like at the Kingdom Hall and shit, that like it's hard for me to sit still and watch it.
No, and those are the really good character moments. And there are others too, you know, like at the end of this episode, we see Camille lies to her editor about, you know, getting consent to go into Natalie's room.
Right.
And goes and then carves the word liar into her jeans, you know, which would be her leg if she weren't wearing pants.
Mm-hmm.
It almost seems like she's carving her own sins into her skin.
Right.
As some sort of weird, like, this makes it okay kind of thing. Or like, I want to feel the guilt of this thing forever.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know,
I want to be reminded of it anyway. Fucked up.
But yeah, I thought that was a good thing. But then at the end, she carves dirt. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, she has already carved many times before, right. Obviously.
Now she's into, like...
That seems important.
...phase of, like, ritualistically, like, tracing the previous... Cause, right. So that's the other thing, is we found out that, like... Because I was on the fence about whether those were real scars. They're totally real.
Definitely, yeah.
And she's covered, like, head to toe, with the exception of her hands and face.
Face, neck, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Like, anything...
And they're definitely... She is the one carving them, you know? There's no, like, supernatural thing. She's done it over years.
Yeah. Makes me wonder how she got the ones on her back and all that kind of stuff. But, like, you know, that might be part of the ritual. She, like, I could totally see her with a stick and a razor blade and a mirror, like, going at it, you know?
Oh, my God. Yeah.
But the other thing about, like, because, like, I think people misunderstand. Like, I don't think that my mom doesn't love me. It's just like, and this was a really, like, when at the end when she's, you know, Emma's melting down and Camille's melting down and she's like screaming, like, I just want things to be nice for us and maybe I don't know how.
Yeah.
Honestly, I don't think a lot of narcissists have that self-awareness to say something like that. It kind of took me out, but it's also the tragic truth because I do think, and ever since, in every instance that I've known narcissists and I've had the misfortune of knowing a few, like, they do want the best thing and they do want things to be like nice and hallmarky, and maybe that's part of the problem because real life isn't all like that all the time and they overreact to the bad times, but like it is a tragedy because they want that authentic love and experience, but the way they go about is just driving it further from them.
Yeah,
it's like the Leia said about Tarkin, the tighter you squeeze your grip, the more that love and affection just leaks out between your fingers, and it's tragic.
I do feel like they should have had Camille say that to someone else about her mother. Like, you know, because like you said, it's too self-aware for somebody who's like that.
Right.
Those people don't think about it in those terms, or would certainly, even if they do, never express it.
Because it's a weakness. It's something like, you know.
No, I think if Camille was like talking to maybe her stepfather or something and, you know, said like, oh, why do she treat you that way? Well, she wants everything to be okay. She just doesn't know how.
Right.
Like, have that conversation between two other characters.
Yeah, I thought the other thing I thought was interesting about this episode is, like, I feel like there was more points of view than just Camille. Like, in the first episode, I felt very almost like this was a first-person view of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas now, like, we got to see the detective kind of doing his own thing with the barber and his own investigation.
And the pig head.
We got to see, you know, so Alan, her stepdad, talking to Adora and, like, you know... he's like the little male spider, like, okay, if I approach her and I stroke her pedipalps this way and I do this dance and I put on the French music that she likes with my hi-fi set, then he tries to like prop her up and help prop her up because, you know, that's the thing he has to do but she just, you know, like all that effort and then just falls to shit and then like, and then he just sits down and enjoys his music. Like, what the hell's going on in his head, man?
I don't know. Like, I'm kind of the opinion that he should have waited a day or something to try and let her grieve a little bit, let her remember her own daughter and her death. Let her process that a little bit, then come in with the French music and the dancing.
Right. God loves
He goes
the world
in a little prematurely, unfortunately.
Yeah,
but
like,
yeah, his... I don't know how you navigate those waters.
That dynamic, like, where you're just always walking on eggshells, and it's the rest of your life. Like, Jesus.
But they seem to have, clearly, a better relationship than Camille and her mother do, right?
Right.
Like the two adults in that family, adults, they're, you know, one's well on her way to being adult. The other is a fucking adult.
Uh-huh.
The eldest of that family, they seem happy and they seem to have a good rapport when Camille's not around, right? And as soon as Camille walks in the door, her mother goes into mother mode and things go terribly wrong.
I mean, there is a certain type of couple that embodies that, like, you know, Sheryl Crow, are you strong enough to be my man vibe? Like, mm-hmm. I'm, you know, like, the incredibly low lows will be offset by the incredibly bipolar high highs. And, like, it's like I'm riding the whirlwind and this is like everything it is to be male and female. And, like, it's, I think it's a bunch of bullshit. But I've seen that again. I know this couple. Like, I've known them several times and it's exhausting. But, like, they take pride in it. Like the way, like, a combat vet takes pride in their purple hearts and medals. Like, like, look at the intense love we have. And, like, it's the passion and all that. And, like, okay.
I think Camille needs to embody the Sheryl Crow can't cry anymore philosophy.
Right, but yeah, it's like that, or the Marilyn Monroe, if you can't handle me at my worst, you don't deserve me at your best, kind of, like, you know, all that you see on Facebook.
Right.
I just, like, man, this guy, I know a lot of people had him pegged as, like, maybe a prime suspect. I don't see it. Like...
That's the point, man.
Yeah.
You don't see it until it's there.
Yeah.
Until you do, and then... You can't unsee it.
I forget who did it. It might have been Josh Black. It might have been Shum. But on the forum, somebody said, like, he's going with, like, the Dwight Schrute. It's always the person you medium suspect. Like,
right.
And you're right. Because, like, I feel like this show is putting, like, bright red warning flags and flashes on people. But, like, it's so hot, it can't be.
Yeah.
And then there's some that are like, oh, look, this guy looks like a normal person. It can't be. I don't know. The other thing is, like, this show. So let's talk about, I guess, the mystery and what we found out about it, because we talked about Camille's mom and her relationship and all that.
Mm-hmm.
They're making a big deal out of this has to be a guy, both for statistical reasons, because statistically, if you're going to get murdered in this country, it's going to be a man doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Just overwhelming, overwhelming. If you had to bet, you're always going to bet that a dude killed you, because women, that's just not, there's a lot of reasons for it, but just safe to say statistically, it's going to be a dude. And how much upper body strength it takes to pull teeth.
Yeah.
The latter thing, I think the first is persuasive just because it's hard to argue with. It's statistics. The second one, it's like, really?
Yeah, I mean, leverage is a thing.
Like, vice grips exist. You squeeze them, you lock them, and you take a hammer and you knock it, tooth's gone.
Right.
Like, I don't, and to me, it's to the extent that, like, I think it has to be a woman who's committing these murders, because the show is spending so much emotional energy putting this blind spot in front of all the investigators that it has to be a dude.
But at the same time, it seems like such an obvious thing that they're doing that I want to lean back.
It violates
toward
the medium suspect rule, but there's only two, it's a binary choice.
Right.
Unless you want to start, like, you know, quibbling about, like, trans identities and stuff like that. Like, it's going to be...
I doubt the show is going there.
Right. But it's going to be, at the end, a biological man or woman, and, like, you know, everybody's suspecting the men, so it must be the women, but they're suspecting it so hard that...
Yeah, that it must be the man. Like, I don't
know
where
this is Princess Bride
that
territory pretty soon.
Yeah, like, maybe this is just the flack, you know? Like, they're throwing up the flack, and then they're going to throw the flack on the women's side, and then there's going to be so much flack in the air you can't see anything, so you throw your hands up and just say, well, we'll see.
Yeah. So, having said that, like, there is a witness to the murder. I forget this kid's name. Like, Khabisi or something.
Jamie?
It's definitely James. Yeah, it's definitely James.
Okay.
Khabisi, that's it. James Khabisi.
Yeah.
I was close. And he saw a woman in white abduct this girl when she strayed into the woods. Mm-hmm. I think that is a clue that we can believe in.
Is it his mother? His mother was wearing white, yeah.
I think he would recognize his own mother, though. And she doesn't seem like the type that gets out much.
Yeah, but would he say it? Would he say it's my mom, or would he have some weird brain thing that tells him... Yeah, it's a woman in white.
Nah, I don't. I mean, you could be right, but it just.
I mean, I don't even really have a theory. I'm
right,
just saying his mother was in white. kids do some fucked up things sometimes.
Yeah, that's true. And he was playing with Natalie, which I thought was also interesting because this kid is like, what, 9, 10, 11, and she is 14, I believe they established. So, like, but again, in small towns, that happens, you know? You don't have ready playmates. Sometimes you, well, shit, we're a perfect example. Like, very rarely would an 11-year-old and a 15-year-old hang out, but we were in a cult, and, you know, you got to kind of play fast and loose with your age associations if you want to, especially if you're a nerd that wants to play board games.
Yeah.
In rural Indiana.
What if Steve was abducted while he's hanging out with Dustin?
Right.
Stranger Things, yeah.
Yeah.
That would seem strange, but...
Yeah, but there's been Stranger Things.
Definitely.
For sure. I don't know. I feel like that's a clue that we can kind of rely on. And I also thought that the discussion between Chief Vickers and the detective Willis, that's his name, right? Richard. I think it's Richard Willis.
He's cop.
Dick Willie. Old Dick Willie. The out of town detective Willis, where they're kind of like sparring you know, Silence of the Lambs style. Mm. And he's like, I've read that book too, Detective Starling. I think they're trying to tell us, like, the normal serial killer rules you need to throw away. Like, all the shit you think you know because you've seen Manhunter and you've seen all the seasons of Hannibal, you need to put aside because it's not going to help you in this case.
Yeah.
Like, they're building us a Rosetta Stone for, like, what evidence is persuasive and what evidence is not persuasive. I don't know how to use that, particularly that particular tool they're giving us, but do you agree with me that they're trying to teach us that this is not a standard serial killer story?
Yeah, I mean, that's the reason you bring up those standard kind of principles,
right?
You know? Is so that you can ground the audience in them so that when it turns out to not be that, they'll go, oh, I didn't see that coming.
Yeah. What'd you make of the townsfolk almost fetishist ritual exiling of the rocks that snagged up Ann Nash's body? And they even reenacted it. Like, they showed, and I guess that must be the detective imagining it, because how the hell would he have seen this? Like, these... Sure. Weeping townsfolk, all of them men, carting these rocks across the town line and smashing them and throwing them outside the community.
No, I liked it. I thought, you know, that's something that a small town with its own sort of folklore would do.
Yeah.
It almost feels a little too, like, Wicker Man-y.
It does. That's like, it's very Old Testament. Like, this building, this family got leprosy in this building, tear the building down and burn it, you know? Or the feedback discusses a scapegoat. Like, that comes from the biblical practice of the high priest taking this random goat and putting all the sins, all the undisclosed sins of the tribe on it and driving it out. So the wrath of God goes and gets the poor scapegoat instead of the nation of Israel. It feels that very old-timey black magic voodoo kind of thing.
Scape rocking,
yeah. These fucking, it's just rocks if they weren't there. I don't know. It was bizarre behavior, and showing it reenacted, I think it's important in a, like, almost a Yellow King kind of way. Like,
yeah, I was about to go there. It does evoke, like, a feeling, certainly, and makes this town... adds to, I guess, some of the layers of this town.
Yeah.
Like, whereas before it was just kind of a sleepy small town.
Yeah.
Now you're kind of getting belief systems into it, which are, you know, not incredibly strange, but certainly beyond some of the stuff that I'm familiar with.
Yeah, like is it a spontaneous display of unfocused grief? Like, we have no killer. We have nothing to take vengeance on. Let's just find something. Or are they playing a game of rules we don't understand? Like, like a lot of shit in Wicker Man doesn't make sense until you get to the end. You figure out, like, what's going on here in this island. I think it's kind of similar. Like, maybe there's something dark and eldritch here in this town. And they're like, you know, this is what you do. And every 15 years or whenever 20 years the child killer comes, you got to smash some rocks. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's also of a piece in my mind with all the imagery of fans and stuff that they're showing us. Like, the intro is loaded with fans. The show is loaded with fans. And I can't tell if they're just trying to evoke the heat in a very visual way or if there's something else thematically that they're trying to do with these fans. Because they're all over the place.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I haven't seen any evidence for that, for or against. So, yeah, it'll be something. Because, yeah, I just took it that they're trying to, you know, always reinforce how hot and sticky it is.
Yeah.
But
why have them, like, in the intro? That seems more important to me.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And, like, the same, like, we haven't gotten to the bloody hooks, but, like, obviously.
And they're associated with the hog farms. And I don't know, something weird going on there.
That's how they butcher hogs in this farm. They get a fan spinning real quick. Jesus. They drive them through a chute, and it is that's how hot dogs are made.
Boom. Yeah. Pork sausage.
Yeah. Pink, what do they call that? The mechanically separated meat?
Oh, yeah.
You're going to see the mechanical separation here this season. I thought it was also interesting how the town folk has these crazy theories. Like, you hear some groups of men saying it's got to be one of those hog butchers because they're the only ones that can pull the fucking pull teeth. Why is the killer pulling the teeth? Why does the killer have two completely radically different MOs? Like, I'm starting to doubt with this episode that this is a serial. This might be
a copycat.
Copycat,
but not even.
Or you know. I don't know. But then again,
like,
I'm not
collector?
A criminal profiler. Yeah, something. There's also a lot of talk about how weird some of these there is a little bit of MO that both of these families, they've said, are ones that keep to themselves. We heard the Dinashes kept to themselves. The Keens, we hear John's girlfriend say, well, no wonder they aren't embraced by the town. They're so weird, and they keep to themselves and all this. And the mean girl saying that's not the cool curls being killed. Also, the fact that, like, Natalie's mom said that she was a tomboy and she was this fiercely independent. And it sounds like they're talking about Camille, right?
Yeah.
It's definitely a Camille type, which... What do you think about Camille's sister of her youth that got murdered? Like, that, do you think that she died of natural causes? Or do you think she was killed too?
I mean, so far I'm operating under natural causes. It seemed like she just got very sick.
Yeah.
Unless there was some ricin involved or something.
Right. Well, I mean, Manchild's by proxy. Like, her mom is, like, deliberately doing something to...
Yeah, she's spiking her tea with... That's
arsenic. Yeah, strychnine, rat poison, pig poison.
Oh,
there'd be a lot of
man.
Pig poison in this town, you'd think. So,
yep.
I don't know, but it's because, like, they mentioned this John might be gay, and they talk about how that makes sense because, you know, the apparently these girls aren't being sexually violated, and, you know, they talk about that this is a sign of unnatural affections with siblings. I don't think John did it, man. Like, he just seems like a grieving brother.
Sure.
That's an outsider in a weird town, and who do you turn to the trust at that point?
I mean, I know it's a stressful time for both of these families, but both the Nashes and the Keens are acting weird. You know, like, there's this fight between Bob and whatever Daddy Keen's name is. When they're having their get-together after the funeral.
The detective.
I would love to know what was said there, what happened there, why that blew up,
and that their daughters used to be friends until they had a falling out.
And you can see on the mirror, like, Natalie has Anne written on the mirror under likes,
and
then crossed out, and then now it's under dislikes.
Like, what happened there? Is it possible that the teenage girls themselves are committing killings? Like, this is the meanest girls.
Emma's killing people.
It wouldn't shock me.
How long ago was the first murder, Anne?
Last August, I think.
Okay.
So it's been like 8-9 months they've mentioned.
All right. I was going to say, if it's like 4 years ago, she's probably a little young to be murdering people, but...
Yeah.
Maybe.
Huh. I thought that was interesting. I don't know what else we want to talk about.
Clearly Bob is like number one suspect on cops list.
Yeah,
because
he's getting soils.
You don't plant trackers or whatever the hell he's doing on the car of just a minor suspect.
And we saw that there's a little bit more of the temper he had because Camille's kind of like casing the joint, and he sees this guy screaming at his child. But then again, every time you scream at your child doesn't mean you're about to beat them or
right.
You know, like, sometimes kids need to be screamed at. And you know, they got the cop taking soil samples. Why? Because they're trying to see if he's been back to that creek, or
I guess so, or maybe just where he's been. Period.
Right. What'd you make of the time where Camille stops and just out of the blue praises elderly resident for taking down signs for Natalie Keene? You find out she also did it for Ann Nash.
I thought they were just trying to give us yes, suspect number one now. No, I thought they were just trying to give us a taste of the small town vibe, you know.
And maybe this is like
the town's looking out for each other.
And this is like the type of person Adora wants to be. Like, this woman's just doing something just to be nice, and she's not looking to take credit and be a hero. She's just doing her part. Whereas Adora is very showy. I need to make sure that people know that I care about this town, and they like it's very showy versus selfless forms of public service, I guess.
Yeah.
What else we want to talk about? Oh, can we talk about the bar scene? We got some info. So I'm understanding that these dudes that were all together and making the jokes about blowjob shots and stuff are the same young men we saw menacing, like chasing Camille and later menacing her with guns in this weird sex murder, animal murder cabin.
Could be. Yeah.
And that they're like, you know, there's like intimations that maybe Camille as a teenager, they would get her drunk and then take advantage of her, or maybe even sexually assault and abuse her. These are stuff I think they're getting. And I thought she weathered that fairly well, honestly. Like, it was something going on in the background, but it didn't ever seem to like bother her.
I mean, she.
I was kind of surprised that the detective himself wasn't like, the fuck is going, you know, like he didn't even seem to react.
But one of the guys walks out, you know, they start making jokes and he just walks the fuck out.
That's not Natalie's father, right? They identify him as Kurt.
I don't think so.
And I tried to do a search for like, and that's probably a bad idea for me not to be spoiled, but like, I couldn't find any information. I don't know who this Kurt character is. I don't know. But they also, the other thing in that scene, we found out that both Bob Nash and John Keene, it can't be Natalie's father because his name's John. They both have weak alibis.
They were both out of town at the time.
But they can't prove it with cell phone records, no tolls that are paid. It was just they have nothing but their own word that they were out of town.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's something to look into.
Yeah. The other background detail is how the town was treating this funeral as a hot ticket. I thought that was an interesting detail to throw in there. They showed a little bit where they actually had headcounts. They had to turn people away, and people were visibly disappointed. And then, like, Camille called it out to her editor. That's something we haven't talked about, the editor and his relationship with his wife.
Oh, okay. Seems like they've been married for a long time.
Right.
Because they know each other really well.
Do you think the wife... Like, because like, at first I thought that the editor's wife was just worried that he was getting enmeshed with this unstable woman and maybe putting her in situations that weren't for her own good. But the second and subsequent interactions, I felt like maybe she's a little jealous that Camille is getting all this attention. But I don't know, because I thought the first scene was really cute where he puts on the song about, like, you know, baby, we've been through a lot together. And she's like, yeah, right, in the background. But I don't know, like, every single time he looked a little bit like, I don't know, maybe it's guilt from him saying, hey, I'll think about it. And then he obviously either didn't think about it or doesn't care enough to like stop. Maybe we're supposed to understand that he is pushing her success at the expense of her mental health, because I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah, I think she's worried about this interaction between, you know, editor and Camille for a couple of different reasons. And they're both kind of summed up in the, you know, the usual things that she says, right? You can't solve every problem for everybody. And she's worried that he's trying to do that, trying to solve a problem that he can't solve or whatever. He can't fix Camille. Don't try. And then what was the other one that she said that turned out to be the one that he latched onto?
Are you sure you know what you're doing?
Yes. Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, he might get in over his head here trying to help her.
Right.
So I felt like she was trepidatious about this whole thing from that perspective, but I didn't think it was more that it was, there was anything more than that.
Yeah, they're also showing, like, they're using background details, like the fact that he's kind of like a fix-it man around the house, showing that he has this natural need that he sees something broken, he wants to fix it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's all well and good for machines, but whoo boy, trying to do it with people get you in a lot of trouble. Get you in a lot of trouble.
Does he realize that that's what he's trying to do here, or that that might be what he's trying to do by sending her home? To get her to deal with some of this shit.
Oh, yeah. Because, like, he even says it to Camille. Like, this is some, you know, like, this, you this will be good for you. It'll be good for your career. It'll be good for, you know, I think
this would be good for people with semi-normal relationships with their family members.
Yeah.
I think this guy doesn't
fully
know what he's doing
fucked.
Here. Yeah, she's, his wife is right about this.
Yeah, no, I think he's messing with powers that he doesn't fully understand. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. Like, you know, I think people from like baseline normal situations often can't understand how fucked up things can get in a home.
Yeah.
Even when it's not, like, obvious, like, abuse. And I'm not ruling that out at all because, like, there's... Mm-hmm. There is some, like, just goes beyond just narcissistic behavior that's happened here. But, like, I think a lot of people have a hard time, like, if you came from a family where, like, you know, unconditional love was a thing, it's very hard for you to understand that, you know, not being the case.
Sure.
So, like, this guy seems like he's well-adjusted and has a good relationship with his wife. It might not occur to him that sending her down here can be anything but, like, healthy,
yeah.
You know? Like, oh, well, yeah, there's some tough love involved and, you know, the difficult, demanding mother and all that. But, like, it can get beyond that. What else did you want to talk about?
That's about all I got.
I have a certified basket full of feedback this week.
All right.
And my wife, Cecily, is helping me prepare it because she mentioned that there was a lot of, or there was some book spoilers starting to sneak into the commentary. So she is pre-filtering Bastards. All that. And I think because she's read the book, I think that now I shouldn't have to worry about, you know, maintaining my purity. So thanks for that, Cecily. Rob C. Something about Emma commenting on Camille's beauty reminded me of the whole case of the Slenderman and the two girls that murdered their friend. Are you familiar with the Slenderman story at all?
No.
Me either. Like,
not
I know
the
that's,
lore behind it. No.
I don't know anything like other. Like, I honestly. I have no idea. Like, I don't know whether he was just a creepypasta, if he's a video game character. Like, I honestly don't understand. Like, him and Jeff the Killer and all this other shit. Like, I don't know what's a Five Nights at Freddy's character and what's this, like, an organic, you know, creepypasta right. thing. Like, I don't know anything about it. So that might mean something to somebody, but it doesn't mean anything to me, Rob. Josh the Black. I feel like the killer is 100% a woman, especially after Sheriff insisted it was a man.
And that's why it can't be.
He also points out the bad women is kind of like a Gillian Flynn thing to do, which
right.
of all the stuff that I've seen her, that does seem like, you know, that does seem like a theme that runs through her work. Here's a few things I caught. Before going to the wake at the house, Camille is scratching the word scared into her arm. We also see it scratched into Camille's driver door. The next time the door is shown, it says sacred.
Mm-hmm.
That's another kind of like True Detective detail. Like, it's, you know, evoking religious imagery in the stuff that she's doing, like this ritual she's doing to herself. And maybe it has something to do with what's going on with these murders, because you don't murder someone, display them and pull their teeth. Unless you're doing something. Like, that makes sense in someone's head, right?
Sure. There's a purpose there.
Same scene. The license plates read Tangle, Punish, and I think Bundle.
Okay.
That was a scene where... I believe that's also the scene where Bob Nash is getting thrown out of the wake. Or the funeral, or the reception, or whatever the fuck it is. The catty woman at the wake asks Camille if she has any children. She avoids the question. Later, Emma's friend makes a comment about Camille being old enough to be their mother. Camille told her boss she wasn't allowed to leave her house for a year after Marion died. That's her younger sister. Is this a red herring, or Camille be Emma's mother?
Oh, my God.
That's actually a pretty strong theory.
I'd say the ages line up better.
I mean, like if Camille got either raped or had these torrid affairs with the town boys and then got pregnant, and on top of the death of her sister, her mom just couldn't just imprisoned her in a house, so she went through the pregnancy and all that and just claimed the child. Because also, I feel like Adora is just on the ragged edge of being too old to be a mom in that situation.
Yeah, that's kind of what I meant.
Like, yeah, right.
Like, Camille's like right on the edge of being old enough to be, and... Yeah.
The thing I don't understand is, I would think Camille would know that, and their rapport does not feel like a mother who's being reunited with her daughter. I'm just talking out of my ass. I don't know what that would look like, but it doesn't feel like that's what's happening in Camille's head. But otherwise, bomb theory, man. I like that a lot. Directly after opening credits in a series of smash cuts, you see a girl standing on a red caboose with blood on her face. A few seconds later, you see the girl, same girl standing in Camille's bedroom next to a mirror. Her face is clean in person, but bloodied in the reflection. Later in the episode, while driving away from the kid on the big wheel being scolded by his father, Camille passes the caboose, and you can see the same girl stepping backwards onto the caboose with blood on her face, and smash cut to the same scene from the beginning next to a mirror. I didn't recognize her, but she's credited as Alice on IMDb. It's funny because I thought that this girl was, Marion, but
Marion.
Yeah, I thought because of the nature of these spoilers, I'm not getting onto Reddit and doing a lot of in-depth analysis on this stuff. So I saw this person and I thought it looked kind of like Marion. So I just assumed it was Marion, because if it's any other woman or girl, how the hell would Camille know about it? Like, I don't think she's getting a premonition about Anne or Natalie and whoever the hell Alice is. Plus, also, IMDb lies a lot. I mean, we just went through that with Westworld.
Or it's just wrong, even if it's not trying to lie.
Yeah. The word Camille is scratching into her tummy at the end is dirt, the episode title. The word you see on her arm at the end of episode one is vanish, also the episode title. So are we just going to see her progressively carve?
Suppose so.
Yeah.
I mean, these words are important. I don't care to like try and dig in deep that I lose my mind. I'm just gonna wait for the reveals.
Yeah. I was looking ahead at the episode titles, and they all seem like stuff that you could see on her body, like fix, ripe, closer, cherry, falling, milk. Milk's weird.
Yeah.
But all the other stuff, like, you know, cherry has a particular dark connotation in this material. Hunkules wrote in, I know it's kind of pointless to make predictions when the answers are already out there, but I'm betting it's the sheriff. The novelty wanted dead or alive picture with the sheriff's face on it was surely prominently placed in the first meeting, and everything that happened with him last night's episode sure seemed killerly to me. It's almost, like I said, the pliers scene is just too much.
Yeah.
Like, you can't be talking about how the killer pulled teeth with a plier and then show this man maniacally pulling on the steel plate with pliers in his hands. Insist the killer has to be a man because he knows it. It seems absurd, but you never know, because they got six more episodes. They could bring it back the other way, and, you know, it's all who is medium suspect at the end.
I'm going to be watching that stop sign, and if it's still bent later, we'll know that he's not strong enough to pull those teeth.
Yeah, if you can't unbend the stop sign, you can't pull teeth, for sure. Texas Sandman, this show turns my anxiety up to 100. Camille is drunk driving for 70% of the show, looking at everything but the freaking road. Someone has to get dinked by her Volvo.
Volvo.
the knockoff Volvo made by, I don't know, some kind of weird Eastern Bloc country. Dinked by her Volvo soon.
This is just... life is different in the very small towns.
Yeah.
Like, drunk driving is not quite the offense when there are no cars on the road ever.
Yeah. Like, I could drunk drive between Mooresville and Monrovia all day, every day, and all night, every night, and probably only see another car or two in the week, you know? Like, I'm not saying...
It's still not a good
idea. I'm not excusing rural drunk driving. No. I'm just saying that it's not exactly the same as barreling down a city street or a highway doing it.
Right.
So I don't know that we are being taught to assume that she's going to plow into somebody. But it could happen.
It could.
It's hard to catch everything in one watch, but I really like the end of the breakfast scene where the housekeeper rushes to put away the 50 knives on the counter as Emma, I think, looks at them longingly. It just feels like everything is foreshadowing, and we could have dived in an extra 5 layers deeper, soaking up all the details. I'm definitely loving the smell of the psychosphere on this one.
Oh, boy.
Agree. What did you think? So, I didn't think Emma looked at them longingly. I think Emma was just, like, depressed that, well... Did she want to go to that funeral? I think that's a performance she's put, because, like, she seemed perfectly content to go day drinking with her friends on the roller skates.
Yeah, and I mean, if she thought that...
So what was that
for? Natalie was an outcast and a loser, why would she care about her funeral?
Like, yeah, right.
Yeah, I don't think she wanted to go to that funeral.
Yeah. GHM3 from the forums. The stop sign scene at the Plyer scene exists only to give the viewers to suspect the sheriff. Yet otherwise, the show seems to be telling us the culprit is a woman via everyone being so dismissive of the notion. Yeah, I think we've covered this topic pretty well. Mm-hmm. Jamie T with some observations. There's a spider in the opening credit spinning its prey, and it's shot to look like they're dancing. There's also a scene in opening credits of Camille's mother dancing with Camille's stepfather.
Aha! Aha!
Alan, you're gonna get webbed up and bit. That's all there is to it.
No, he is the spider.
Oh, you think he's the spider?
Yeah, he's the spider. That fucker just looks too normal.
He's
too well adjusted.
Well, get a load of this. I don't know how true this is, but there's enough killer female spiders that spiders have come to symbolize a feminine threat. From dreamdictionary.com, the spider is symbolic of feminine power or an overbearing mother figure in your life. I didn't pull that out of my ass. I'm actually weird enough to have dabbled in dream dictionaries for over a decade now. All right? Hmm. I accept your dream dictionary definition, Jamie. The victim's four-post bed was decorated in butterflies, both in the sheer curtains and on the pillows. However, there was a spider hanging in the middle of it, a spider in her bed. And if that wasn't obvious enough, she also plays with spiders in her free time. Did you notice how perfect the victim's teeth were? My dental x-rays are a fucking mess in comparison, and I've had a lot of work done. No, I didn't. I did admire how perfect the victim's teeth were. I wonder if that's... Are we supposed to notice that?
It's the genetic lottery, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. In observing family or Camille's family more, I think Camille has always been the scapegoat daughter. Her younger sister was a golden child, just as Emma is now. She included a write-up of the scapegoat versus golden child in A Narcissist's Home, an article on psychologytomind.com. I'll put it in the show notes. The thing about the golden child in psychology is they're not perfect. They face their own hardships. They receive abuse just of a different kind. But from what I've researched, they naturally take after their parent a lot more, which is why the parent attaches to them so strongly. Having a scapegoat helps unite a dysfunctional family. Emma threw Camille under the bus at the end of the episode, playing along with her mother's scapegoating of Camille, and Camille responded childishly to that, getting annoyed as though it was personal. I don't mean that in a judgy way. I just mean that I don't think it was personal. Emma is young and has to act this way in order to survive. Disagreeing with her mother would be a hell she's had no experience with, and silently disagreeing with her mother is too risky. Better to express agreement and move on. I don't see this as disordered behavior. I see it as a victim trying to survive. I do think she's a burgeoning narcissist, but I don't think the dark side has consumed her yet. What do you think of that analysis, Jim?
Yeah, it seems pretty good.
I think something's wrong with Emma, though.
Like, yeah, I mean, she's clearly not like the golden child. She's pretending to be.
Yeah,
but
she's playing
that
role in the family,
as you said, like her mother.
Right.
That's the only thing I would disagree with is Emma is very much not like her mother.
Yeah. Well, but you know,
she's much more like Camille.
Was Adora a wild child back in the day? Ashamed of it and now want you know.
Yeah.
You know, because I've seen that in narcissistic individuals too, like this whole Madonna horror complex, and they get to be adults and real and think that like they just consumed the shameful things that they did, and then when their kids started doing, you know, anyway. This isn't my therapy session. It's ostensibly a podcast about all television. Is Camille's body a metaphor for the town? All covered up, nothing to see here, but all this pain and rage underneath.
Could be.
I liked it. I liked the metaphor. I strongly identified the scene where Emma was talking to Camille for help or asking Camille for help with the alcohol. As the black sheep and or scapegoat of my family, I've been a go-to for this type of stuff, too. You get some kind of sad pleasure of at least helping their lives be easier, but of course they'll high-road you later when it suits them. You have to be careful because bad parents turn siblings against each other. In sum, main suspect last week, Camille's stepfather. Main suspect this week, Camille's older lady friend. Interesting. I don't know
I thought it was Jackie.
Yeah, I don't know what Jackie's done to get everyone so upset with her, but
she's just suspicious. She's too loose.
Because she called Amy Adams beautiful.
Yeah,
really.
She's got a crush on Camille.
It is interesting how
I don't know. It's weird.
When last episode she said beauty, beauty, beauty to her.
Yeah, and that creeped me out.
And then Adora said, "I love you, I love you, I love you" to Emma.
Yeah.
Interesting. Telephone of Madness. I'm not sure if I should answer this call, honestly. It's a telephone of madness.
Madness?
This is Rick Grimes talking, answering the telephone in a prison season, man. Uh-huh. Who knows what doors will open here? If Camille's sister had a chronic illness, I can totally see why Camille's mother, or she was Camille's mother's golden child, because one of my dark triad family members is like an illness-seeking missile. I'm glad to see how many of our Bald Move audience is as fucked up as I am, I guess, because they're throwing around terms like dark triad. Are you familiar with the dark triad?
No, I don't know what that is.
It's a cluster of personality traits that, like, essentially form, like, malevolent qualities or psychopathic qualities, and they are...
Drunkenness, skin carving, and teeth pulling.
No.
No?
It's narcissism, Machiavellianism, and psychopathy.
Okay. Wow. Yeah.
So
you don't want all three of those.
No. No. That's that's not the three cherries you get and win a jackpot. That's three poop emojis you get, and it dispenses human misery.
Yep.
Anyway, she loves to latch on to people who have serious terminal illnesses because the targets are grateful for the help and or too weak to challenge their dominating behavior. It allows her to play the martyr saint and be told what a wonderful help she is being. She gets to steal attention from the target's visitors. She gets to remind everyone how irrelevant their problems are compared to the poor so-and-so. And they enjoy actually watching them suffer. That's a compelling...
Yeah.
That's I think that's a compelling suite of psychological observations you've made there, Telephone of Madness. At the moment, my money is on Adora being behind the killings just because she's the psychopathic elephant in the room. But maybe the husband is helping her pull teeth because apparently a woman can't pull teeth. Female dentists take note.
Yep.
When I saw her at the end of the town, at the end in her gown holding Emma, I thought, "Where? There's the woman in white." Although I think the gown is actually light blue. Is it possible that the way we can not make the binary choice between choosing a male killer, female killer, is that there's two killers working together?
Yeah, the duo.
Like, Alan's so far under her spell that, hey, you know, I'll engage in some light murder with you of a teenager if it means I'll get to listen to my French orchestral music in peace for a week or a weekend. You think there's something to that? Or it's a Jackie Adora combo?
No, but sure. Yes.
You don't think that it's a possible two killers working together?
Oh, yeah. That's always possible. It could even be more. It could be the whole town. We could have a hot fuzz situation going on.
Oh, my God. A hot fuzz situation.
Yeah. Why not?
They're going to be wearing those apocalypse cloaks and intoning things about keeping the order. All right, I can get down with that. I do think it's interesting, the idea that, like, we're looking for a killer, but there might be two. And it would also neatly solve why there's different MOs.
Right.
And, you know, maybe, like, that's why the teeth pulling and the framing is they're trying to, like, make it seem like a conventional serial killer to throw them off the trail. I don't know.
And could two women working together pull a tooth? Is that possible?
I think so.
Would the sheriff even admit
if they used every bit
possible?
Of their lady strength and maybe some leverage, mechanical advantage, maybe they could get a mouthful of teeth out. Maybe.
I hope everyone knows that we are speaking in the highest sarcasm here.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope people know that.
Yeah.
But then again, I don't know. Probably good to explicitly say that. Yeah, the other thing about the someone pointed out, I didn't include this for feedback, but the sheriff is saying use this term, a cry for help, a lot. And they want to be caught, and maybe that explains some of the, like, when I was reading that, I'm like, well, this seems kind of far fetched, but now at the end of the podcast, is there something to that? Like, maybe the sheriff is being, like, so shady in plain sight because...
I don't know. I mean,
what's his motive, though?
Yeah. It's in the same scenes where you're talking about, you know, them essentially pointing out the obvious stuff about serial killers, and it's going to turn out not to be that. So it'll be one or the other.
It is interesting that, like, I think the sheriff is of Adora's generation in this town. He is from the town, but, like, we don't know anything about him. His family, whether he, like, you know, I'm assuming he's not from old money, or why would he be the sheriff? Or the chief of police. I guess that's different than sheriff. I don't know. I just don't see him as a suspect.
I feel like there's a reason why there are two cops from different locations in this story. I don't know that one of them is going to turn out to be the killer, but I think that's an important factor here, that one of them is from the outside and one of them is from the inside.
Maybe Vickers isn't the killer, but he's helped cover it up. Like we,
right.
That was one of the false flags in True Detective. Like you think it's this little toady sheriff character, but he is actually just being paid to look the other way by powerful interests.
Yeah.
And if you're talking about the old money of the town and, you know, maybe. But then, and maybe that's why he's so hostile, because he first called him in there because he didn't know and now he knows it's connected to the old money, and now he wishes the guy would go away because it makes his job of covering up harder. I guess you don't need a reason other than money and power to be complicit in killing someone.
A lot of people will not ask questions if they can either get paid or rewarded in some other way for it.
Right, and if their betters are telling them, oh, this is something you don't need to worry about. Of course we didn't do it. This is all, fascinating show, and we'll be interested to see how the next 6 weeks go. The only thing I can say for sure is that we will be back next Tuesday with another episode of, again, coming down off the all-television thing just to talk about sharp objects. If you'd like to send us feedback, please do so at tv@baldmove.com or in our non-spoiler discussion on the forums. I know there's several people have read the books, but they're keeping that stuff to themselves at forums.baldmove.com, tv@baldmove.com, forums.baldmove.com. We will see you next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later. You know the number one question I get on the Bald Move TV podcast, Jim?
No.
How do you guys cover all of television?
Oh, good one.
How do you come up with the budget to do it? Like, it's just such a vast in scope. And the answer is we've got this thing called The Club. Club.baldmove.com allows our listeners to directly support us. Don't have to take money from the man, though we're willing to.
if it's a lot of money, if the man has to pay extra.
Shit, if it's out there in the streets, I'm going to pick it up.
It's a man tax. I'll say that.
The man has a man tax.
Yeah.
And we can avoid that by being primarily listener supported at the club, club.baldmove.com. It's good for us, obviously. Why is it good for you? You get the satisfaction of supporting a independent podcaster. You get a lot of extra features. Like, so if you like me and Jim, well, there's a lot more of us. We're doing bonus shows like Quip, and we do video game playthroughs, and we do Lunch with Jim and Aaron, which is our variety show that we host every Friday. It's a perfect way to cap your end of your week. You get ad-free feeds if that's something important to you. Check out all the benefits at club.baldmove.com. You can preview a bunch of them for free. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial. Check it out, club.baldmove.com.